Welcome everyone to this really exciting event, or I hope you're all going to find it as exciting as I am. Wayne Jordan is clearly known to some of you, but I suspect others have, like me, until at least relatively recently, not heard very much about Wayne Jordan. He's been actually working extensively at the Abbey as director, and as you will know, also writer, and this version of Oedipus that we're going to talk about today was by him. And it was because of the Oedipus, a play that interests me a lot, that I suddenly became aware that there was not only going to be a production, but also a new version. And I think those of us classicists know that that is, particularly in Ireland, an occasion to take considerable note of, because for the best part of the 20th century, definitely after 1926, when Yeats's celebrated version was staged finally, and I say finally because in a way it was perhaps the longest translation in gestation, because it began, or at least rumours of it began in 1904, when the Abbey was set up. But it didn't actually finally come to the stage until 1926. And what has been really noticeable about those of us who are interested in Ireland's engagement with the classics was the one play, and particularly since the 1980s, when it seems to be that every time one looks in the repertoire of an Irish theatre, there is, and the London theatre, there is another version of the Greek tragedy by an Irish playwright. The one play that was always conspicuous by its absence, and I dare say because of the shadow, the burden of Yeats on younger writers, was Oedipus. And over lunch we remembered that there is one, I think, quite parodic version by Derek Mahon, perhaps the one writer who would have sufficient chutzpah to take on the Oedipus. But anyway, what struck me was there was this, for me then, unknown Wayne Jordan, who had not only decided to put on, or been invited rather, to direct Oedipus, but was also producing his own text. So that was my first awareness of his work. And I have to say the second one, for me, is really important. I had an amazing student, undergraduate, working on the option, the finals option that I convene in the faculty here, which is called the reception of poetry, Greek and Latin poetry in English since 1900. And she decided she wanted to work on this new Oedipus, one of her texts, and she decided to write to Wayne. And blow me down, this wonderfully generous man, I realised, not only answered her email, but also sent her text. So my first encounter with the text was with this student, and I think I told you last summer when we finally did meet, was that this, she wrote a fantastic piece, I have to say, on it, and she submitted her work with in an appendix with this text that I had never seen before. What was terrible, it says, this text is not to be kept. So after the exam, of course, I'm giving too much away about the examining process, we had to throw, or rather it ended up in some vault somewhere, and no one was able to see and read Wayne Jordan's text until we met, wonderfully mm-hmm. met, at Hoth Literary Festival, thanks to Marina Carr last summer. And I have to say, since Oedipus, you've gone on to do so many more things, and perhaps the most recent of which was indeed a collaboration with Marina Carr, when you did something equally massive, and that was an amazing version of Anna Karenina at the Abbey just before Christmas. So I knew that not only, and obviously last summer met Wayne in person, but I just knew I wanted to someone who was so bold as to tackle Oedipus, but also was so generous as to share their work with someone who just happened to email them. You may not after today want to do that. anyway, what we thought today was, before we had our conversation, what was electrifying for me last summer in Hoth was when I heard Wayne read some of his text. And we thought that was a way to start today. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to sit down, and over to you.
Cool. Okay, cool. Hi, everyone. I'm going to read the section from Oedipus where the messenger arrives and relates that Oedipus is well found, that Jocasta's killed herself, Oedipus has found her and ripped out his eyes. And so this is the bit from my version. Citizens of Thebes, the sights you will see, the horrors you will hear, the sorrows you must shoulder when I tell the story of Oedipus. The rivers of the world couldn't wash away the sin that now comes to light. Evil known and unknown, a darkness propelled by fate, a chaos chosen in ignorance, and he himself the cause. Jocasta is dead, by her own hand. The how is the most terrible part. When she walked into the hallway, she was frantic with grief. She ran straight to their marriage bed, slamming doors shut, tearing her hair with her fingers. She called to Laius. The child you gave me was the death of you, and I was left alone to bear his children, both his mother and his wife. She tore at the bed where she gave birth twice over, husband from her husband, children from her child, and then Oedipus was there, wild and shouting. She shut him out. He called for a weapon. He begged us to tell him where she was, the wife that was not a wife, the twice ploughed field that bore his children and himself. In his madness, God showed him the way we didn't. We just stood there, dumb. And with a blood-curdling cry, he jumped at the doors as if he were pulled by a string. He ripped the hinges from the walls and flung the wood before him. He fell into the room and we saw her hanging there, swinging from a twisted noose, the queen. When he saw her, he roared, the noise of an animal, and he took her down, untangled her, and lay her on the ground. What happened next emptied my soul, put a black hole in my vision. He took a pair of golden brooches from the folds of her gown and held them high above his head. They glinted in the light. He lifted his face toward them and plunged their sharp pins into his eyes. He punctured his eyeballs in their sockets, screaming all the time. They will not see me now or the things that I have done, the evils I have suffered. They will stare out blindly at the world, a world they should never have seen, trapped in darkness, failing to recognize the faces they look upon, just as they fail to recognize my mother and my father. As he screamed these things, he raised his head and brought the pins down on his eyes again and again. The burst and bloody eyeballs soaked his beard and caked his face, and what spewed forth was no slow stream of oozing blood, but a river of black juices, a downpour of pitch. Across his cheeks, a storm, a hail of dark fluid. This is what flows forth from the crime of our king and his queen. A chemical reaction to the marriage of mother and son. They were happy then, but now they know and nothing will comfort them. Grief and shame and death are their family now.
Well, I've mentioned Yeats, and I feel that perhaps here in what we've just heard, some of our listeners might hear, I don't want to maybe sidetrack, but I mean, we'd definitely hear, I think, some echoes of Ted Hughes, and I think as much Hughes' Seneca, Seneca and Oedipus and anything else. But elsewhere in the text, very definitely one hears Yeats. And I just wondered, you know, is it possible for you to sort of talk to us about the relationship, if there is one, between your Oedipus and the Yeats' Oedipus?
There's definitely a relationship between my Oedipus and the Yeats' Oedipus. I guess in terms of provenance and where the production came about, I was working at the Abbey for quite a while when 18 Howard, who was the literary director, started a kind of project of exploring Yeats's plays and the ideas that went into the creation of Yeats's dance dramas, and with a view to potentially programming a series of those plays. Unfortunately, the Abbey never did program a series of those plays, but the time that we spent working on them was really kind of exciting and dynamic. And also, it was interesting in terms of more than interesting, it was kind of, I guess, inspiring or arresting as an artist who was working so much at the Abbey to think about what Yeats's vision for a national theatre and for a national theatre in Ireland was, what he thought the theatre could be, his belief in what the way in which theatre could be part of the transformation of the, I guess, activation of the Irish soul. So then Oedipus, I've always loved the Greeks, but I did classics in school, and the first plays that I was able to read well were the classics. I found Shakespeare hard, and the classics were really clear, and Oedipus was the first of those plays that I read. So when I came across Yeats's version, I was kind of excited by that, and also his project, which he write. So I'm kind of going on a bit of a tangent now, but Yeats saw a production of Oedipus in Notre Dame in America, and at that point Oedipus was censored by the British government, and so he was very excited about the prospects of coming back to Ireland and programming a play that was censored by the British government, which he felt that the Irish would really understand and would have no problem with those kind of issues, and then basically we would be better than the British. I'm more, you know, extraordinary in that kind of way. And he also, and in writing version, Yeats wrote a prose version with verse choruses. In writing that version, his project was to write something that he felt was distinct and clear. And I think the quote is that from everyone from a scholar to a pot boy would be able to understand. I'm not sure how many pot boys Yeats knew, but that would be able to understand. And the version's really good, particularly the choruses are really. And I quoted some of the lines from it in my version, particularly the line, "For death is all the fashion now, till even death be dead." And so I had at one point really wanted to, I think in 2010, I was proposing that I wanted to do a production of Yeats's Oedipus. And it almost happened, and then it didn't happen. It caused actually a bit of a rift between me and the Abbey for a while, but, you know. Later on, then an opportunity came to do a version of it in a drama school. So, but when I returned to Yeats's version, I felt it wasn't actually as fluent. It's awful to be sitting here criticizing a Nobel Prize winner. I think that Yeats's play of Oedipus is supremely excellent. I just think practically it doesn't always work to contemporary ears, and so it no longer. So Yeats no longer suited my purposes. When I returned, so I did do it for a student version of Frank McGuinness's really very wonderful version, and it was I had in that kind of like, oh captain my captain way, like I had this extraordinary time with these students working on Oedipus, and I was delivered into a new understanding of like a lot of things, like what it meant to be a person, what it meant to work, what it meant to put on a play, and I hope they were so I thought, oh, I'll fight to do this again. And the Abbey agreed to do it, and also agreed to allow me to do the version or translation. And what I wanted to do was follow, I guess, the impulse or impetus, or my interpretation of the impulse that Yeats had. And part of the reason I didn't want to continue with Frank's was, well, as someone who had done some successful versions of things before, it was an opportunity for me to do one, and I often think of my kind of translations or adaptations of work as an extension of the interpretive act of directing anyway, so it means I was just kind of directing from the language up. Although in lots of ways I was trying to focus on kind of listening to the play as opposed to kind of reworking it, or I was trying to find something that was in it, or returning to the kind of first principles of drama or something, it was like a quest to listen to what was there rather than to apply my own idea onto it. I did have some ideas approaching the text, and they were to find, I guess I wanted something darker and sparer than I was finding in some of the versions I was finding had a little more ornament than was useful for my purposes. And the spectre of the kind of Ted Hughes inspired by Ezra Pound's Seneca's Oedipus that he made for Peter Brook was the oozing black blood of that text was something I wanted to bring to Sophocles. I didn't do the Seneca because I wanted to make something about community and citizenship in a way that I feel the Seneca play isn't about. I think that's a kind of general kind of tour around the provenance of.
Well, I must say a reread, as I did last night, of your script, and I think you got a taste today from the messenger speech. Your text is unbelievably lithe and supple, and so you
thank you.
You definitely succeeded in that. I'm also interested in sort of relating to what you've just said. And also, I think you said in your program note, you said that your version of Oedipus was a very, well, not to say very, but it was definitely political. And, you know, it would be very, I think, interesting for the audience, for you to, if you can cast your mind back to, I don't know, 2015, if by political you mean something narrowly, immediately resonant, or am I mistaken?
I heard political resonances for the world and city I lived in when I was reading Oedipus, and then was trying to kind of, I wouldn't say foreground them, but certainly make them available to be heard by the people who came to see my version of Oedipus. And the things that I was interested around that were, I was really interested in like this extraordinary feat of denial that Oedipus is involved in, like to like, and to have a truth so clearly, so clearly stare you in the face and manage to be like, that's not the truth. Alternative facts. There were two so I was really interested in that, and I was also really interested in, I'd made a lot of work in the Abbey about kind of like communities, and I'd say the themes of my work had generally be like community, sexuality, and bullying, and so it was, I was really interested in making something about kind of a community being like, well, how do we continue to be one? Is this the end of everything? There were two particular thoughts that were in my mind when I did, when I came to do the version. One was a quote by Fintan O'Toole, who's kind of the, is an Irish kind of chronicler, let's say, and he wrote in his book Ship of Fools, which is about the 2008 crash in Ireland, that one of the essential qualities of being contemporary and Irish is the ability to be able to keep two utterly opposing ideas in your mind at the same time and never having to introduce them to each other. And that seems like a really kind of great way of looking at Oedipus, like in terms of, it seems like almost everyone at some point seems to know both the truth and two truths, the truths they're willing to accept and the one that would threaten them, and doesn't, you know, and it moves through the play without actually, with the two of them activating each other like ends of a battery, but never actually putting them off each other. And the other was a little cartoon I saw on Facebook, which was like, the first cell of the cartoon was a teacher at the top of class, or a speaker like at the top of class, saying, who wants change? And everybody in the class puts up their hand. And then the next cell is, who wants to change themselves? And nobody puts up their hand. And it was that idea of like, how much we want the world around us to change, or can see, and how hard it is for us to accept change within our own lives, or to volunteer or put that out. And I think that was my own feeling of being like a citizen, or thinking like being an activated citizenship in some sort of way. Like, how do... And in 2015 as well, the referendum, the gay marriage referendum happened in Ireland. And I think a few things about it. One of the things I think about it is that it never should have happened, because I don't think that the majority gets to vote on human rights. However, it did happen. And it was an extraordinary event, or extraordinary phenomenon across the country, where people really seriously, like adults, talked about how we wanted to live together and the kind of country we wanted to be. And luckily it went a way that made me feel comfortable, or more than comfortable, very proud to be a part of the country I lived in. But you know, thinking about how we live together, the way that we could live together, was kind of there. And so that was one way in which I feel the play is political, rather than that I was trying to make it political, I guess. And my production was very much like the chorus were kind of undeniable in a way. We had a mixed-gendered chorus in that it wasn't all men. And the play, which was originally meant to be, we were originally meant to be set in the middle of the theatre, so the audience sat all around, but only a few weeks before it became impossible to do that. So there was like 100, we had 100 chairs. And actually they were kind of, most of the chairs were from like cathedrals and churches, and the idea was that it would look a bit like a Quaker meeting. We dipped all the chairs, so there was nothing on stage except these 100 chairs and a table and a glass of water. And the chairs were all kind of dipped in acid so that they looked
they look like ghost chairs, but they were just chairs. And I guess the empty chairs were all the people who weren't there anymore. But there was a substantial course of about 16 people. When I was casting it, I had this idea in my head that they would look like an aisle from Lidl, mm-hmm. like that it would like they would just take an aisle from Lidl. They also sang in like as many as 9 parts beautifully. So they were an aisle from Lidl who could sing beautifully. in a way, the music was the mask. There's a quote by, I think it's Lecoq, which is like, the chorus is the street raised to the level of the mask. So I was really interested in how can I make something that is really involved with that, where we're approaching the play with psychology, but also there's another element, you know, that meets or honors the kind of heightened nature of Greek theatre. So in a way, yeah, I was trying to get people to think about how do we all live together, mm-hmm. and also the problem of having a leader and being a leader, and like, yeah, denial, community. They were kind of the key ingredients, I think, in the answer to that question.
Lovely. And I think a number of people, again, would have been particularly struck when they heard that the Abbey gave you a chorus of 16. I mean, that's quite unusual for, you know, even sort of subsidised theatre. And they also gave you, you know, this wonderful composer, Tom Lane.
Yeah, yeah.
For whom there was a new commission and uh-huh. so on. And could you talk a little bit about that, you know, collaborative process? And
again, I think we had this term that, it sounds kind of precocious now talking back, but we had this term we applied all the time. We were like, what we wanted to make was a feat of extraordinary listening. I think my work in Ireland is known for being kind of theatrical. Like, I've made like electro pop musicals and like Irish dance and hip hop shows and stuff like that. So for me to make a play that where everyone just listened was kind of edgy for me. And also I was really interested in kind of like, what does it mean? And you know that idea that the carved amphitheatre was it was an ear in the side of a hill, which, you know. So with Tom, I was also interested, how do I make a group of people talk together and also represent the spaces between them? When I'd worked on choruses, and I'd done a lot of work, mostly with students, on Greek tragedy, I was always more interested in the way a chorus kind of works, not as a voice that all agrees, but how it's kind of like a brain. You can kind of feel like this, you know, the way in your own brain, like I hardly ever agree with myself. You know, like, you move toward one goal, but you're like, oh, is that the right way? Or no, don't do that. Or, you know. And so I was kind of interested in how do you create those gaps in a chorus and still have them all talk together. So with Tom, we were really interested in how musically we could literally represent dissonance through music and tension, and have voices talk back and forth to each other and have different qualities of voice. So it also really influenced the way in which I wrote the script, because when I was first starting to write my version, it was really fantastical, very contemporary version in which like ghosts like got trams and ate burgers. And like, you know, it was this idea of kind of, I was really interested in the idea of starving modern ghosts. The famine rises to set again. But we only have so many tropes. Anyway, as I was working with Tom, you know, if he wanted to write music, I couldn't have as many words, because obviously we didn't have like we wanted the play to happen fast, like a thriller, but it is a thriller. So I had to write less words. And that was, when I hated it at first, and then I got really into it. And and you're kind of like, well, what is the without losing what, not without losing what Sophocles did, but I was trying to keep this more than the spirit of what Sophocles did, but apply a kind of austerity to it, I guess, in a way. Someone in the Irish press called my production Corbynite. Isn't that bizarre?
I was going to say, maybe that's something we can pursue.
Well, it was 2015 was a very different, people had a very different idea about him then. There was a kind of... I had to find a way to kind of keep the choruses full of image and thought that could go against each other, but also with little enough text that the actual voices and the lengthening of voices could open them up. And then Tom had to find a way of making music that was both, you know, he was using kind of contemporary classical aesthetic, but that kept some sort of narrative drive, because he had a tendency to kind of fly off into kind of something a little too abstract to keep tension in it. So anyway, any sort of collaboration with anyone, because aside from his problems and my problems, it was all of him and all of me, and that's a whole load of something in any collaboration. And so, like, how do we listen to each other? How do the chorus listen to each other? All of that. And there was other things. I mean, there was also a voice coach and a movement director. Being a theatre director takes a lot of patience. Well, I tend to be quite a collaborative theatre director. As in, I wouldn't be so kind of... Or at least I put on the show of not being tyrannical, you know. And so there's a lot of kind of, yeah, listening.
Yeah.
But he changed me and I changed him. And that, I think, made it good.
Yeah, no, I suppose I can hear the chorus. Mm-hmm. You know, having spoken to you and having heard what you've said now, but I'm still interested to know how they moved. I mean, you said there was a movement director or choreographer. Could you say a little bit?
The movement thing was really interesting, because my work is often very kind of kinetic.
Yeah.
I mean that both in terms of, like, it's very physical, but also, like, you know, movement creates movement. You know, it flies off. But interestingly enough, and I had all these chairs, so, like, you know, clearly you'd be like, oh, they should pile all those chairs up or something. We did pile them up, but it didn't want to move an awful lot, because the quality of being in Oedipus, if you're in the chorus, is like, you know, it's not like anyone makes a sudden movement and it's over. Like, you know, game over, they're going to get hit. So we started, there's this game that it's a game we played a lot, which is kind of, I think there's another name for it, like Pussy Four Corners or something like that. It's like everybody sits on a chair and one person's in the middle and you have to try and get, if you move off a corner. Anyway, it was, so we worked a lot with this very kind of physical game, but the thing that we extracted from it was actually the bit where everybody was still, you know, and how active and physical listening was. Like, listening with various different parts of your body and also kind of, and toward the end, as things got more, but also Oedipus was the only person who really had a lot of room to move. Like, when I say room to move, like status to move. He had quite an obvious limp in my version as well. So he had a crown and a limp, and so he would be very kind of powerful, and also, you know, he was kind of dragging a foot longer. He was physically very capable, but you just noticed it. It gave him a loping movement. I think I was surprised, actually, that the production ended up being so kind of still. A lot of people afterwards were like, could the chorus just move wherever they wanted? Were they allowed? But they really weren't. It was like directed within an inch of its life. So I guess the successes in it were that it seemed very natural. But pretty much everything was built through a negotiation. You know what I mean? Because when there's that many people on stage and you have a short rehearsal time as well, people need to know where each other are.
Absolutely. No. I'm struck by... two words. One, the verb listen, and how important listening was in your production, but also again how it was by no means a kind of frenetic production, but it was about stillness. And, you know, immediately my next question would be, where was the kind of metaphysical dimension in your otherwise quite political production? Was it there?
No, definitely. I mean, they did move fast. I don't know why I feel I need to defend this. They did move fast sometimes.
Oh, no, you don't need to defend it.
Yeah, just generally, like, generally they were in a state of readiness rather than one of kind of action, between two things, the tension between inaction and action. Mm. It looked like a mass, like that. Well, it was supposed to look kind of like a Quaker meeting, but like it's in Ireland, so everyone's just going to see a mass. One of the reasons I think why I wanted to draw some of the kind of dark quality or obsidian. I'm going to use the word obsidian. The obsidian quality of the Ted. The Ted uses Seneca's Peter Brook's Oedipus. Was that in working on it with the students? I had done a lot of work with, like, Aeschylus and Euripides, well, particularly with Aeschylus. When I was working with Sophocles, I started to feel like there was a doubt about God. I know it's not explicit in the play, so perhaps it's just my reading, but the gods never seem to answer like this. Do you know what I mean? There's all of this pleading and all of this silence on the other side. It often made me think that Tony Kushner did a version of the Dybbuk in which a rabbi kicks everyone out and pleads to God, and God doesn't answer. And he's like, God's gone. And then he has to go back into the room. But anyway, I remember that. The memory of that moment from the play, I was like, that I feel like in Oedipus, there's like a suspicion or a crack is opening. I was saying to you earlier on that I often think I was quite naive in terms of how committed I was to this reading, but I was very influenced by René Girard's book, The Violence and the Violence and the Sacred, when I was doing my version of Oedipus. I had done it in a course called Theatre and the Tragedy and the Tragic, in which my friend Nancy did in college. At the time in college, I knew I was attracted to it, but I couldn't digest the thoughts of it properly. And when I was doing, I had this job basically in RADA and Trinity started a drama school called Lear, and I teach there. And my job there was to do these Greek tragedies every January with the second years. And I'm working them, I started to remember him, and I went back to him, and I became really kind of interested in this idea of the sacrificial and how kind of groups get together. And I was also reading I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, Elias Canetti, mm-hmm. like Crowds and Power. And I was interested in kind of like sacrificial victims and like, again, it's related to the ideas about bullying and also what it means. You know, if you put yourself out and you're going to be a leader, then are you going to end up dead? Like, is that sacrifice or shunned or, you know. Ireland's having a lot of change in its artistic directorship in the major theatres at the moment, and I've been having a series of lunches with the leaving directors, and they're all talking. They all talk about how nobody will talk to them, and their lives are really cold. So although I don't feel that Sophocles is in any way saying that God doesn't exist, I felt that there was a cold wind blowing whenever anybody was praying out there. And that felt important to me. We talked again earlier about how that was related to the political, in that in Ireland, obviously, in the 90s, people stopped really being... I think it stopped being a religious state. There was really... Which meant there was about 70 years of Catholic fascism, really. Again, talk about Fintan O'Toole. Fintan O'Toole made this documentary, about which I have lots of feelings, but it was a documentary where he talks about how playwriting was dying in Ireland. But one of the things that happened in it that I thought was remarkable was a lot of the older Irish playwrights, I'm including Marina here, so Marina's only maybe a bit over 10 years older than me, but people from an earlier generation, were often talking about what are we going to do now? The writers aren't there because Irish spirituality was gone. Now, whether Irish fascism, Irish Catholicism was ever spiritual, I'm sure, you know, some people were spiritual, but whether culturally it was a spiritual culture, I'm not sure. But I was kind of interested, you know, are we in a situation where God has stopped listening? Or, I don't know. It's more of a question mark than that. I have a point that was there for me when I was making it. Mm.
I think a lot of people as well. I mean, I've asked you a bit about your version and how it may or may not relate to Yeats. But I think a number of people in the audience would be particularly interested to know how you engage with the Greek original text. And we've had a little discussion about it. And I know that you worked at mm-hmm. least with, in the early stages, with Michael Lloyd, who's mm-hmm. at UCD in classics. And I wondered if you could talk about how you as a writer, yeah. We talked about very much you as a director on this project, but you as a writer, how you work with the text.
Well, again, so I've never been a particularly great linguist. In the other versions of things I did a version of a French play, which I have, I can kind of read French, so I just kind of painstakingly went through it. And then I did a version of a German play, and I knew, like, I'd done some German up until junior cert. That's like O levels, I think, the middle thing that you do.
Now called GCSEs.
GCSEs, okay. Yeah. I had And I just, I used a dictionary and I read all versions of those things. But I couldn't get close to Greek because I don't read Greek. I don't have any Greek and the alphabet is not the same. Actually, we got in touch with a few people, and people like Michael Lloyd and other things were like, oh, you know, there's literal versions available, so you can just use them. But I really wanted to have at least some sort of relationship with... I wanted to feel I'd done some work to get closer to it and that I could ask about syntax and, like... And it wasn't just comparing versions. And also, I needed to be liberated a little bit because having directed Frank McGuinness's version, I knew loads of it off by heart. And I knew, of course, lots of other versions of it. I like that Robert Fagel. I'd read that as a student. And, you know, it's The Gods Go Down. So we hired Michael, and he did a literal translation, and then he very kindly gave me about 8 hours of conversation around it. And after that, I was kind of finished. I was able to kind of go and work from his. Work from his version. I also had the Loeb and another literal around, and then after working with Tom for a bit on the courses, it became apparent that this kind of pairing back was the key. So I don't know if this is interesting, but my version is kind of sometimes there's only a word on a page, right? So my approach was if a word couldn't take a line, then
word,
it wasn't
word on a line.
Yeah, a word on a line. Yeah. So it's not word on a page. A word on a line. So I felt if words couldn't carry the weight of a whole line, I kind of got rid of them, basically. So I lay it out, really measuring out the value of words, and thinking about do we need this word at all? And the character of because also Greek tragedy is very hard to perform. Maybe some of the more poetic ones, I was also trying to blow open this kind of, I'd always had this received knowledge or received information about the Greeks, that kind of Aeschylus was Eugene O'Neill and Sophocles was Arthur Miller and Euripides was Tennessee Williams. And that was just how you did them. And I felt that there was this kind of dark, Gnostic kind of terrifying thing behind Sophocles that really I was afraid of that didn't, although now I kind of feel that probably is behind Arthur Miller. I mean, Ivan Van Hove has kind of blown that as well, maybe in the end. So I was trying to kind of, measure it out. Anyway, the Greeks are hard to speak. Well, this play particularly, I've found whenever I've taught it. And Antigone as well. It's hard to speak because it's not that there's no subtext, but they mean everything they say. They're really talking directly on the line. It's absolutely exhausting for contemporary actors because they're so used to short sentences are not really meaning what they say, or particularly in, I don't think there's a huge, I mean, obviously there's differences in the Irish English character, but in terms of actor training, we're quite similar. And it's, we don't, yeah, it can be hard to kind of speak it. And so I really wanted, I don't know why, but I was really trying to create a script where no one could hide anywhere. And that really they were all out there and like they were on a bright white light and they just, And also because it was so extraordinary that they were all lying and denying a thing that was just being splayed open by the language they were using constantly. So I guess that was the way in which I was kind of approaching it. And also I love reading out loud. I spent my entire teenage years running around my bedroom pretending to be Cordelia or whoever I could be. I did that for my leaving, so it's not that particularly love Cordelia. So I spoke it out loud all the time, weighing up and words. That was kind of the approach to writing. There was a Jessica Traynor was the literary director. She's a poet, a very good poet actually. Jessica Traynor, Dublin Swim is the name of her book. But she was the literary director at the Abbey at the time, and I worked very closely with her. She was really good at kind of encouraging me to be more brutal with the pairing back. So.
And so, did the rehearsal process change the text quite a lot?
Yes, it did.
From what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the problems with Oedipus, it's kind of the problems with Yeats. There's no problem with them, but one of the things that didn't kind of fit the purpose or is the last kind of third or so of the play. It's after he cuts out his eyes, it's really very long, and they repeat a lot of things, and perhaps a lot of that was sung, or some of it was sung, or the way in which it was performed had a more kind of originally had a more extraordinary ceremonial or musical or way of being performed, but when it's performed psychologically it can seem kind of well, hard, you know, we're getting the same thing again. So a lot of that went, and I pared more back. But even reading it last night, because I haven't read it in about a year, even reading it last night, there's loads that I cut.
We've mentioned, or you've mentioned Aeschylus a couple mm-hmm. of times, and the Greek O'Neill, as we will now call him. In some ways, because of your interest in chorus, as you said before, it might be that Aeschylus would be, I mean, I think you've already suggested you've worked a little bit with students before on Aeschylus. Would you like Yeats, who refused to contemplate Aeschylus? In fact, I think it was Gilbert Murray at the time who said that Aeschylus was absolutely, you know, Aeschylus was the play to do, not Sophocles' Oedipus, if you remember, because Aeschylus was much more Irish than Sophocles. as it was, Yeats was right that he could be much more Irish and much more political if he proceeded with his plans to stage or try to stage the Oedipus. But how would you feel about if someone gave you the opportunity, one of these new directors that are going to appear, to put on Aeschylus, only because it was last year in London for extraordinary reasons, and in fact
there were three
there was Manchester, the Exchange, and then the Globe, and
it's funny the way things turn up, though, isn't it? Like, it was like like Richard II just seems to be on everywhere these days. And I can't ever remember them being on in the 90s or anything. But
And then of course the Robert Icke. So how would you feel about
that? Made me think of a couple of things
that are not
the answer to that question.
One is
just that it's how Yeats's Oedipus is a Civil War play. Like I really think it's a response to the Civil War. He's writing a play about a country that is decimated by kind of lies and subterfuge and confusion, and that kind of row between Creon and Oedipus is very much that kind of like brothers fighting each other, and also the idea of everything that has to be denied and can't be talked about or lived through, and the experience. There's something I think this is related to this other thing, and which is about how the reason, because I always thought Aeschylus would be the playwright I would do. I would have assumed, if you'd asked me when I was 22, like, what would be the Greek play you would do, I would have been like, oh, well, the really long one is probably the answer I'd have given, but yeah, the Aristeia. I think by the time I came to do Oedipus, I was really interested in something about kind of personal identity. I don't know how to be a man. I don't know whether that's exclusionary as a thought, but I'm a man, so I was thinking about that. And how to fully integrate things into your life. I feel like part of the Irish project over the last, say, 10 years maybe, particularly around the time of like the Ryan report and the crash and stuff, was Ireland having to integrate really terrible truths about themselves into our life, you know, and even the Good Friday Agreement, and you know, of going, well, all this stuff happened and we have to let it in because otherwise we're vulnerable to it. And I think that's Oedipus's story, and I think that's the way they apply. However, onto Agamemnon. I really like Agamemnon. I totally love to do it. I think part of the reason I really like Agamemnon is because of the choric speaking in it. I've done it twice with students. I did, I think, the Kenneth Dalglish version, and I've done the Ted Hughes version. Only Agamemnon, though, not the rest of the Aristeia. And I've also done a version of the Suppliants, which is a brilliant play. And I think that Ireland could really do Ireland this, Ireland that. But you know, we haven't had. I've never seen an Aristeia there, and I. Certainly as a country that's been so involved with the idea of what we are as a nation and founding of a nation, defining ourselves in opposition to other nations and so on. And also a country that like basically inscribed the disenfranchisement of women into our constitution. In fact, it's still there. You know, it seems like a play that would really, really speak to Ireland, the third play, or the Aristeia, the third play particularly. And the character of Clytemnestra and the kind of doublespeak, you know, and that she has to do the entire way through is brilliant. I think it works really differently to the way, because I think it's active in a way that the chorus and Oedipus aren't. Like, the, you know, I think they're really trying to make things happen in a different way. And I think their relationship with the audience is more storyteller-like than the chorus and Oedipus. Oedipus kind of feels a bit more Ibsen-esque in a kind of, like, you know, we go through a keyhole to hear what's happening within the community, whereas I feel like the community in Agamemnon come right out and go, this is what's happening, you know, and this is what has happened. Both times I did it, I kind of made my choruses were kind of like Charlie Chaplin. They were like they were old men, because they were men and women. I had to come up with some sort of mask, and it felt that they couldn't. Unlike Oedipus, it felt like the chorus couldn't all be women, or couldn't be mixed. It felt that they needed to all be men for the story to really work, and for the tension between Clytemnestra and them to be clear. So we kind of did this kind of. Some version between a kind of Charlie Chaplin's tramp and like a kind of middle European bureaucrat, and that was the way that we kind of created it. But so that's what I've done with the performance. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I haven't thought it, I mean, until you mentioned it today, I haven't like thought about it much.
Lovely. Well, I noticed at the time, and I what we thought we would do we would get Wayne to read another short speech from the play before we open up to questions from the audience. So
is that cool?
Absolutely. So can we have a
example? Cool. This is basically Oedipus's backstory. It's when he tells Jocasta's just revealed you know, her story about how she had a son with Laius, and that Laius or that she sent it away, and so Oedipus then tells her his story. My father was Polybus, king of Corinth. My mother Merope was a Dorian. I was the best man in that city. That's what the people thought of me, until one day something happened, something was said. I let it in, I shouldn't have, I should have let it go. A drunken man at a drunken feast over cups of wine with stinking breath sidled up to me and, with his arm around me, announced that I was a bastard, that I was not my father's son. I saw red in an instant, but I kept myself together. It was difficult. I wanted to rip at his grinning face, but I didn't. And the next day I questioned my mother and father. They were livid at the laughing fool who threw his accusation at them and at me. And I was soothed by their anger, but the thought kept nagging at me. It wouldn't go away, and the rumour spread. So unbeknownst to my mother and father, I set out on the road towards the oracle at Delphi. But Apollo had no interest in the question I came to ask. He replied instead with a bitter revelation. He said that I would lie with my mother and breed children in her, a brood of monsters. He said also that I would murder the man who fathered me. When I heard this, I ran. I fled the city of Corinth. Putting miles between us, using the stars as my guide, I left that life behind and took my chance on a new path to somewhere where that prophecy would never be fulfilled. And so I came to the place where three roads meet. I will tell you, wife, the whole truth now. I stood there at the crossroad where they say the king was killed. I was weighing up my options and deciding on a route when a man in a carriage with a herald and an entourage came thundering toward me on the road from Thebes. Two of them, the leader and the older man himself, bore down on me and tried to drive me off the road. I lashed out in anger and hit the driver hard, and when the old man saw this, his face was a storm. He struck me with his whip and I hit back. I hit back twice as hard. I hit him with this hand, and he toppled from his chariot into the dust, and then I killed them all. Jocasta, if Laius and this old man are one and the same, if they are, then is there anyone in nature more wretched than myself? Who is more hated in heaven, laughed at by the gods? I'll be turned away from every door by friend and enemy alike. Who here could ever look me in the face again? I have cursed myself if this is true. And these are the hands that killed the king of Thebes. These hands, this man who took his wife to bed. Am I never to escape the evil of my birth? Must I always run and never return home, or else be married to my mother and murder my father, Polybus, who raised me up, and Merope, who loved me? The heavens cracked with cruelty when the gods wished this upon me. Never, never let me live to see that day. I pray I vanish from the sight of men before I'm stained with that terrible shame.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? John.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you. I was thinking about other things in the Abbey Elizabeth repertoire, in particular about Casey.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's a kind of a comparison in there?
Yeah, maybe.
Sorry, can I just say, I'm going to have to repeat the question because we're recording. And the question, if I'm right, is Wayne has worked with O'Casey, yes, before, or the Abbey. O'Casey is important. Are there connections between O'Casey and tragedy?
Between O'Casey and Edith of Sweden.
Oh, sorry.
The collapse of a family within the collapse of the system.
Particular connections between O'Casey and Oedipus, are there connections?
I've done a lot of O'Casey at the Abbey, and I did a production of Shadow of a Gunman just before this. But I definitely think that part of why I wanted to do Oedipus was I did Plough in the Stars at the Abbey in 2010 and again in 2012. Plough in the Stars, if anybody doesn't know, it's kind of like the national play in a way. It's a play about the 1916 rising, or at least about the people in the city of Dublin during the 1916 rising. And I was very much thinking of that earlier on when I was talking about how the themes of my work had been about at the Abbey had been about community and citizenship, and that play is very much about the disenfranchisement of women and the moment when Ireland, or at least O'Casey's interpretation of the moment when Ireland chooses romantic nationalism above all other possibilities for the nascent Ireland, because many of the people who fought in the revolutionary period were women or socialists or gay or various other kinds of people, but one idea won, you know, in the end. And Casey tries to mark that at the moment of its beginning. So in one way, it's thematically related, yeah, and. It was in 2010 that I wanted to do this play, and it was just after I'd done O'Casey. Whether like I could kind of critically or analytically draw comparisons to them, I was led from one to the other. That's probably the best answer I have to that.
Yeah, David. Yeah.
Could you say something about verse and prose? Mm-hmm. There was a very strong iambic beat when you were reading, but I take it as prose. I mean, is it a useful distinction, or is it?
Sorry, just repeat it. Yes, the question is, what is the relationship between verse and prose? There is a clear iambic beat in your version.
Yeah, no, I noticed that. I find that in loads of plays versions that I've written. Like, I did this version of Marivaux and I was reading it the other day and I was like, this is in blank verse. And it was written in prose as well. I think I was conscious, particularly in that section, I wanted it to sound like, from very early on, or at least as it developed, I wanted you to become more and more aware of the sound of the chariot coming down the road, so that it had a kind of chicka-choo, like a train-like kind of feel to it. And I think I definitely use a kind of blank verse rhythm often and then interrupt it or change it or move away from it. I wasn't purposefully trying to have the play be in kind of recognisable verse, but I was definitely kind of, I guess I was kind of playing with the space between verse and prose, because that felt like a useful place to be. And again, a lot of the, there was something about the way I had to rewrite the work that I, like my early drafted work, in order to make the phrasing appropriate for the writing of music. And also ways in which I could get control over Tom, actually, to be honest. You know, the more I indicated in my writing, then I'd be like, oh, that works. Do you know what I mean? So that had a kind of, yeah. When we talked with Michael Lloyd, Tom and I were really interested in the fact that, other sections of the, or certainly his what he communicated to us, but that other sections of the play were also sung as well as the choruses, and that we think that he seemed to think that people knew that by the changes in verse or so on. And at first we were like, oh, will we have lots of people, you know, will other people say, because in our version only the chorus sang, but then we were looking at whether Oedipus would
And I think something about kind of the spaces in between singing and speaking and verse and prose and was kind of hovering around in my thought. Is that an answer?
Mm.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Oliver.
Can I ask you more about a word that you used? When you're talking about paring down your language, you said that you, the way you worked on the language so that it could be played psychologically.
Oh.
I was wondering if you'd say
I don't know if I was paring it down in order that it could be played psychologically. I was.
Can I just try? No. Yeah.
I know it's really handy because I can think as well as you're doing that.
The question from Oliver Taplin is: you mentioned that your text is pared down. You've been paring down your text, and you also mentioned psychological readings. And did you mean that they're connected, or what did you mean by that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a question I'm actually quite interested in. I'm not sure that I was paring the text down in order for it to be rendered psychologically. I think that I was paring it down in order to try and really meet what was there and what needed to be done with it. I was aware in paring it down that the tools that I have as a kind of contemporary theatre maker who makes drama as well, so there are all sorts of different kinds of contemporary theatre makers, people who make postmodern work, but in the acting teaching I've done and the kind of tradition I've kind of built my work around, primarily the tools and language I have when I talk to actors is psychological. We talk about their motivations, why they do things, what their backstory is, what their history is. That's very difficult to apply to Oedipus because sometimes the truth is kind of like floating, you know, and also because the way in which they speak to each other is so bare compared to the way, say, Irish or English people would speak to each other. They're so on the line, on the thought. So there was a challenge. I think I was aware in pairing it back that I was challenging myself and my collaborators to test really, could the play be performed psychologically, and what, you know, because psychology isn't, it's a tool, but it's also an ideology. It's also kind of ideological. Do you know what I mean? To be like, you know, this was written at a time when people didn't have what we call psychology nowadays, and I guess I was interested in the collision between the two, in the two things. I rely a lot on psychology, whether it's pop psychology or psychotherapy or those kind of things, and the language around them in my life. And it was interesting to think about, are we missing a beat, you know, there.
Yes.
I was wondering, when you mentioned with the Yeats and the British banning it, but back then of how the Catholic Church viewed Oedipus, but relating to now, and you said about the appealing to God and nothing coming back, and I wonder if now with the Catholic Church in Ireland that people won't appeal to God like they used to, and I don't know how.
Oh no, that's definitely true.
Can I repeat that? thinking about the ban, the question is, back at the beginning of the 20th century, which actually didn't relate to the Catholic Church, it was the British censor related to incest, actually, bizarrely. But thinking now about modern Catholic Ireland, or postmodern Catholic Ireland, as Wayne was saying, where maybe there is little sign of God, or God has retreated, or whatever, how now might people relate to Oedipus?
I mean, people have definitely retreated from the Catholic Church in Ireland. I think maybe it's even worse. Like, maybe it's even worse than that. There's no God somewhere in Sophocles. It's like God's evil. Maybe that's like,
Maybe the Greeks had less of a problem with that. I don't know that they were so tied to the idea that God was good anyway. But there's something kind of shocking about, I mean, maybe that was the revelation that Irish people had.
Like an Old Testament.
Yeah. But, you know, like we all thought we were the sinners, but they were in the end, you know. I guess it's an interesting thing to think about. People, God and organized religion, you know. It's been hard for the Catholic Church, I'm sure, in Ireland. And there are things like being gay or lesbian or a woman with a single woman with a child that you wouldn't have dared to be in public in the 80s. And now I can think it'd be pretty embarrassing to say you're a priest, to be honest, which is a big turnaround.
Yes, please. Nancy.
I'm interested in your view of Jocasta and how you were looking at her in the play, because I know that when you were in a student, you drafted a book on Antigone, mm-hmm. but Oedipus feels much more male, and I just wondered about, you know, we've had massive debates in Ireland recently, and the Greeks being so brilliant with women. How did you feel, what did you want to bring to the Greek women being so brilliant characters? What did you want to bring with your portrayal of Jocasta?
The question is from playwright, Irish playwright Nancy Harris. What did you, Wayne, bring to the character of Jocasta?
Again, it is kind of the surprise of doing Oedipus or being drawn to Sophocles, rather than say Euripides or something, because, you know, one of the main reasons I'm a director is so that I can work with actresses. I would be known for my work with the kind of major Irish actors who are women. And Jocasta's quite a cold part, actually. I think probably we talked more about things that were traditionally related to the domestic or the feminine, whether that's what women are about, and you know, so many women aren't about those things, but we talked more of those in relation to the choruses and their lives than probably we would about Jocasta. Jocasta's kind of an extraordinary character. She's a huge amount of power. You know, when she comes into the scene, she seems at least equal to those men, if not more, if not a leader by her age. There are all sorts of kind of, you know, my research, there's all sorts of writing about, you know, is Jocasta really the leader? Is she a trophy that passes from one to the other? Is she more central to, you know, and he's right. It seems always, of course, that Sophocles himself is writing a metaphor about some, you know, he's using a time before to talk about the time that he lives in now. And she doesn't give an awful lot of away. I mean, like, what's so exciting about her is how cool, she's like a Pinter character or something in a way. Like, the language is so terse, and she says such extraordinarily shocking things about what she's done. And of course, talking about, like, tying up and killing a baby in Ireland has a whole other level of things, you know, in that people, you know, abortion is still legal in Ireland, and we've had very famous cases like the Anne Lovett case where a woman died, a young 15-year-old died giving birth to a baby under a statue of the Virgin Mary. So there's something about her kind of callousness around that. It's not that she's callous, sorry, that's a judgment on her, because we don't know that. We just, you know, she says it and she has a lot of power around it. I was kind of interested in the mystery of her. I didn't feel that mystery was like what people would think of as traditionally feminine, you know, but rather, you know, she's cool and political and powerful. And I'm interested in the kind of sexuality between her and him. You know, that feels kind of real and noticeable, you know, to me. They seem to be a good partnership. And the woman who played Jocasta is a Scottish actress called Fiona Bell, who's, you know, she's a force of nature, you know, but she's very exacting, very kind of cool, clear-headed, technical, I think that was kind of stuff that she brought to it. But I feel that Jocasta keeps back her story the whole time. She gives away as little as she can. She's the person who knows everything. It's deeply tragic what happens to her, but I feel like the extraordinary thing about her is how little she gives away and how much she's kind of on top of it, how much more traditionally male she is than him in a way. You know, she's got much better public face than he has. There's kind of a new, I always feel there's a kind of a new leadership thing around him. He's kind of a golden boy, a kind of Kennedy or an Obama or something. Do you know what I mean? And she has a much colder, kind of more kind of traditionally Republican stance on, you know. And I liked that.
Yeah, I think we have time just for one last question. Yes, John. Yeah.
Okay, hi. I think the issue in Oedipus is not that the gods exist, but the issue is, do they care about you? Yeah, which maybe if the gods care about us personally is a Christian phenomenon.
Yeah.
Because in the end, Apollo is proved right. Apollo is a theme through it. In the several trips to Delphi, that whole thing. So I think that the issue with this might be that they didn't actually care about Jocasta and Oedipus.
Can I repeat the question? Because I find it really hard to not do.
You do it better than
I think what John is saying is that perhaps the problem in Oedipus is not so much that the gods don't exist, but rather that the gods don't care about us. Because Apollo is proved right in the play, but doesn't seem to give much of a damn about Oedipus's fate. I think you're probably right there. Yeah, I think in lots of ways, what I do, kind of scrambling around to understand why you're making anything, you know, is I'm applying my own kind of atheism or agnosticism or struggles with that, the language of that to think. But I think the question is much more complex than that. And also, it's much more terrifying if someone doesn't care about you than if they don't exist, isn't it? More upsetting. You're more insignificant if someone's ignoring you than if someone's not in the room. So I think it's a really... As I said before, my attraction to the play was I felt there was a crack in belief, you know, in faith, that he was starting to smell something beyond, whether it was a lack of care or an absence, and that was what I was following rather than I was trying to give an answer to it. But I would definitely agree with what you said.
And there is the hubris question.
There is the whether he's being, are you saying whether he's being dealt a hand because he's proud, like that,
yeah,
his pride,
yeah,
is a sin.
Yeah,
yeah, there is that. Yeah.
There is.
He is a man more sinned against than sinning, though. I'm like, you know, well, maybe I shouldn't. You know, I mean, he's a bit proud. Like, you don't have to make him have sex with his mother after that, do we?
That might be a good moment. At least,
quote.
At least to stop the public discussion, and we can now. I hope you'll be able to join us over a cup of tea, and I'm sure Wayne. We'll answer many more questions and share various stories with you as well. But before we do that, we really must thank him very warmly for coming over and talking to us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.